طفلة تمتطي قوس قزح، طفلة تمتطي.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, where each week you will hear the Palestinian narrative, the Palestinian perspective, the Palestinian voice exploring the realities of the Israeli occupation of the Palestinian homeland. You will not hear this narrative very often in the Western media, which is why it is important that it is presented each week on This Week in Palestine. This Week in Palestine was created by Sharif Pham and is continued in his memory. This is your host, John Roberts. This morning we take a long look at the work of Badil, a Palestinian organization which works with and represents Palestinian refugees throughout the world. Lubna Shomali from Badil has been touring the United States and made several appearances in the Boston area, and we recorded one of those presentations at the Lincoln, Massachusetts Library for broadcast on This Week in Palestine. Lubna was born in Palestine but raised in Michigan, receiving an MBA from Michigan University before returning to Palestine, where she currently works and resides. Here is Lubna Shomali from Badil speaking at the Lincoln Library.
Thank you, Steve, for that wonderful introduction and for that fantastic list of activities. We're actually invited to the November 11th conference on the 100th commemoration of the Balfour Declaration. And our director was supposed to attend, but unfortunately his visa was denied. So, yeah. Anyways, you know, what can you do? I'm here today, and I will try to do the best I can. As Steve said, I represent an organization. Our full name is Badil Resource Center for Palestinian Residency and Refugee Rights. And as our name indicates, we are a human rights organization that specializes or attempts to specialize in the issue of refugees and what creates, what makes a refugee, and how you resolve refugee issues and how you deal with a refugee situation. And specifically, we are focused, of course, on Palestinian refugees and another category or group called internally displaced persons. And I'll explain what that means a little bit later on. I would like to point out that we have one very important resource for you, and that is our website, www.badil.org. It's on the screen there. If you go to that website, you will be able to find our publications that both Shana and Elsa worked on while they were with us at Badil, and really fantastic publications that put into, as Steve said, into the legal framework what the situation is in Palestine, particularly pertaining to issues related to refugees and residency and non-residency and so on and so forth. If you're not into reading 100-page long research papers, because it's not everybody's cup of tea, I totally understand that, you would benefit from our Vimeo site. So if you go to our website and you click on the Vimeo tab, it's on the right side, it's that little V, and you click on it, we have a whole bunch of very short and concise and really expressive documentaries. One on the Old City of Hebron, which I was hoping to show today, which is only 7 minutes long, but we won't get a chance to show it because we're having some technical difficulty, which is fine, because then I can assign it as homework. And then I will check back with you guys to make sure that you saw it and maybe send you a pop quiz via email or something like this. But it really is expressive and will explain or show a lot of the concepts and a lot of the issues that I'm going to be talking about today. There are also videos on there about Jerusalem. There's four videos on Jerusalem. The most recent video that we put up there, which is about 20 minutes long, is about the 100th commemoration of the Balfour Declaration, which is a very important moment or its period in Palestinian and world history, because it was very impactful to that whole region. And we also have videos on what we call practicalities of return, what return would look like or should look like according to international law and best practices when Palestinian refugee return occurs. And if you're interested about those things, you can take a look at those two short videos there as well. My talk today is going to be on what Badil has coined or come to call the ongoing Nakba. And so many people, and I would hope that you also know what the Nakba is or what the Nakba represents, and it's that time, a period between 1947, 1948, 1949, when hundreds of thousands of Palestinians were made into refugees. Okay, and so Palestinians call that time period the Nakba, or catastrophe. And unfortunately, what we experienced during the Nakba, we continue to experience today with different mechanisms. So what's happening is that there is ongoing displacement or ongoing forced transfer of the Palestinian population that perhaps started during that time and was quite extensive during that time, but it hasn't halted since that time. It hasn't stopped. It's not a period of history where we can say it happened at this time, but it's no longer happening. No, it's something that continues to happen to the Palestinian people. And I'll explain a little bit more about that term and get into a little bit more detail later. Very quickly about Badil. Badil in Arabic means alternative. And originally, Badil was created as an alternative specifically to Oslo, the Oslo Accords, the peace agreements between the Palestinian Liberation Organization and Israel. And the reason being is that the Palestinian refugee community and displaced community was very dissatisfied with Oslo, even from the beginning. Because the Oslo Accords pushed the refugee issue to final status negotiations. And so Palestinian refugees felt that the refugee issue, or the issue of Palestinian displacement, is the core issue in the conflict, and this is what we also believe at Badil. And so this should be a focal point in any type of peace agreement or peace treaty between the Palestinians and the Israelis. And so as a result of several meetings and seminars and conferences that happened after, shortly after Oslo, at the request of the Palestinian refugee community, both in Mandatory Palestine and abroad in the Shatat or diaspora, they requested that there would be a body created, an organization created, that would work to promote and defend their rights according to international law. And so this is our goal or our mission at Badil, to promote and defend the rights of the Palestinian people, but particularly those who have been and continue to be displaced according to international law. Now, we use both frameworks of international humanitarian and human rights law, as well as refugee law. So we're talking about at least a dozen different international treaties and conventions. And we compile our legal analysis from those treaties and conventions and bring that forth in our research, along with evidence that this is actually taking place and how it's taking place in the particular mechanism in which it is happening on the ground in Palestine. Okay? Another thing that makes Badil unique as an organization, besides our comprehensive rights-based approach, is that we do not limit our work in terms of geographic scope. If you look at where Palestinian refugees reside or where Palestinians were displaced to, you will find that they exist in almost every corner of the world, in almost every country. And they are not limited to what is now Israel and Palestine, nor are they limited to the area that is referred to as the Middle East, but they exist in many other countries as well, like the United States, like the European countries, even in Asia, and in the African continent. So they're virtually spread out all over the world. And so we don't limit our work in terms of just Palestine-Israel, but rather wherever Palestinian refugees reside. OK? Okay. Another issue or another factor that makes our organization unique is that we do not limit our work in terms of time. And to better explain this, I'd like to go to the next slide. This is also a visual created by Badil, so we don't just create 100 and 200 page research reports that nobody really reads. We also create visuals like this. And this visual shows, sadly, or attempts to show, or the explanation behind this visual is that forced displacement and transfer has been a long part of our history. It started as early as 1917 during the occupation by the British and the transformation of Palestine into the British Mandate for Palestine. And forced displacement and transfer has been followed us through this whole period all the way up until today. So even today, as we talk about Palestinian refugees and IDPs, or internally displaced persons, more Palestinians are becoming refugees and internally displaced persons. Now, while in 1948, the Nakba, the catastrophe, or in 1967, the Nexa, or smaller catastrophe, we saw huge waves of displacement, or the creation of huge numbers of Palestinian refugees. We still saw displacement before those periods, in between those periods, and after those periods. Hence that term, ongoing Nakba, or ongoing catastrophe. So I've been throwing around a few legal terms, and I'd like to just take a moment so that we're all on the same page and we all understand them in layman's terms. There is an action or a situation that is called forcible transfer or forced displacement under international law. And by the way, this act is considered a crime according to international law. Depending on the situation, it could be a crime against humanity or a war crime. But either way, it's absolutely prohibited according to international law. Now, we have to understand what this term means and what the terms associated with this term means. So there is a category under international law called forcibly displaced persons. And underneath that category are two subcategories. One is refugee. The other is IDP, or internally displaced person. Now, the difference between the two is geographic or logistic. A refugee is an individual that is forcibly displaced or transferred and crosses an internationally recognized border. So, for example, Palestinians who are displaced during the mandate, forcibly displaced during the mandate, and left mandatory Palestine and crossed into the neighboring countries, those individuals would be considered refugees by international law. Palestinians who were displaced during the Nakba and left what came to be called Israel and entered into the West Bank, the Gaza Strip, or the surrounding countries, those individuals will also be called refugees according to international law. Similarly for the situation in Syria, Syrians who are forcibly displaced or flee Syria and cross the Syrian borders into other countries, they are considered refugees. However, if an individual or group are forcibly displaced and remain within the entity, okay, and they do not cross an internationally recognized border, they are called IDPs, or internally displaced persons, okay? So Palestinians, for example, who were displaced from the Galilee to Jaffa, from Jaffa to Haifa, from Haifa to Nazareth, from Nazareth to the Nakba. These are all areas within what came to be called Israel, but they were internally displaced. They were displaced but did not cross an internationally recognized border. Same can be said for Palestinians inside the West Bank. You guys are aware that the Oslo Accords divided the West Bank into areas A, B, and C, correct? Okay. So area C is the largest portion of the West Bank. It's 60%. And Palestinians are displaced from area C inside the West Bank into areas A and B inside the West Bank. So again, we have internal displacement there. Okay? Is the distinction clear? Okay. So regardless of this geographic or logistic distinction, as a forcibly displaced person, regardless of whether you are defined as a refugee or an IDP, you have the same rights according to international law. And there are two main categories or two main boxes, let's say, of rights. One is your right of return, your right to return to your place of origin and habitual residence, okay? And the other one is your right to live in dignity during the period of your displacement or during the period of your refugee status, okay? Now, those are the two main rights, and those are the two main rights that when we talk about international protection for those who have been displaced, those are the two main areas that we are referring to, return and living in dignity, okay? Now, it's important to understand what constitutes force under international law, and there are two definitions of force. One is that traditional type of force that occurs during armed or violent conflict. So the physical violent removal of individuals, groups, or communities when there is armed or violent conflict. So what happened in 1948, what happened in 67, what's going on in Syria, what's happening periodically in Iraq, what's going on in Yemen, and so on and so forth. That traditional type of force that we all recognize as causing displacement or creating refugee or IDP populations. The second definition of force, or recognized definition of force by international law, is the type of force created by a coercive environment. And this is a legal term. And what it means in layman's terms is the creation of a situation that is so unbearable that an individual really has no choice but to leave his place of origin or habitual residence. Okay? And this is not obvious, because what happens in a coercive environment is that there are numerous human rights violations. Violations like access to freedom of movement, or access to services like healthcare or education, or let's say access to natural resources like water and land, that make it impossible for a community to survive in such situations. So it's a very harsh environment. It could be created by a natural disaster, but it could also be man-made or created by states, which is the case here. Unfortunately for us, Israel is quite adept at using both types of force, the force derived from armed or violent conflicts, and the force derived from this coercive environment, okay? In order to deal with the Palestinian refugee and IDP situation, the United Nations created two agencies. One is UNRWA, the United Nations Relief Works Agency. How many have heard of that one? Most people have, okay. The other one is the United Nations Conciliation Commission on Palestine, or the UNCCP. How many people have heard of that one?
Is this a Tony Blair's work?
No, that's the quartet, I think, is the one you're referring to. Yeah, that one's new. That one, the quartet, is a fairly new alliance between the great powers in an attempt to supposedly bring peace and prosperity to the Middle East. But yeah, I'm not going to venture down that road today. That one probably needs a lecture on its own, right? Yeah. The UNCCP was actually created in 1948 with UN Resolution 194. If you're familiar with UN Resolution 194, it's the main resolution, not the only resolution, but the main resolution put out by the United Nations that speaks to the right of return of Palestinian refugees and IDPs. In that same resolution, they created the UNCCP. Now, remember those two rights I spoke to earlier, the right of return and the right to live in dignity during the period of your refugee status or situation or displacement? They assigned each of those rights to each of those organizations. So, UNRWA was assigned the right to live in dignity during the period of your refugee status. So UNRWA's job was to make sure that Palestinian refugees and IDPs had access to the essentials, basic services and essentials, in order to live out their lives during their period of refugee or displacement in dignity. Okay? So initially UNRWA was providing things like blankets, food, healthcare, clothing, medicines, water, and so on and so forth. As the Palestinian refugee situation became more protracted, UNRWA became a service-oriented organization, and they're providing or attempting to provide, within their limited capacity and budget, two main services. One is health care for Palestinian refugees, and the other is education for the Palestinian refugee youth. Now, they're attempting to do so, but unfortunately they're struggling, as many organizations are struggling, to meet their to meet the demand that is there. And the international community is not being so supportive in terms of providing an adequate resources, particularly funding for this organization. The UNCCP, while it continues to exist today, is a very defunct UN body or organization. They have one staff member. The office is in New York, not in Palestine. This individual has one task, and that is to report to the UN each year on the progress that has been made with regards to their assignment or mandate. And the UNCCP was mandated with that first right that I spoke of, which is the right of return. The UNCCP was told that they had to coordinate, facilitate, and implement the right of return of Palestinian refugees and IDPs. Now, each year they do submit a report to the UN on the progress that has been made, and each year that report is about two or three lines long, and the report says that no progress has been made, because no progress has been made, because to this day, not one single Palestinian refugee or IDP has been allowed to exercise his or her right of return. Now, normally this work or these tasks are assigned to the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees. So all other refugee populations all over the world fall under the scope or the belt, let's say, the work of UNHCR, the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees. The UN created these two bodies for Palestinian refugees because they wanted to ensure that Palestinian refugees were able to exercise their rights, whether it was the right to live in dignity during the period of their refugee status or whether it was their right of return. So their intention was to create enhanced protection for Palestinian refugees. The reality is that it completely backfired. And what ended up happening is that through the creation of these two mechanisms, not necessarily through their creation, but not giving them the teeth or the authority or the resources to be able to implement their mandates, they created a huge protection gap for Palestinian refugees. What does that mean? It means because of that protection gap, we are the largest and longest standing displaced population in the world today. Now, some of you might stand here and say, wait a minute, Lubna. Syrian refugees are 11 million. Your numbers up there are only about 8 million, right? That 11 million of Syrian refugees and internally displaced persons, that constitutes a little under 50% of the Syrian population, 49 point something percent. Our population, 66%, almost 67%, of the Palestinian population have experienced displacement at least once in their lifetime, with significant numbers having experienced it more than once. Now, we're not particularly proud. We don't want anyone to have this particular title, the largest and longest standing displaced population in the world, but this is the sad situation in which we find ourselves. Now, these numbers that you see up here, you can find in a regular publication that Badil produces every 2 years called the Survey of Palestinian Refugees and IDPs. And we provide in that piece of work, that piece of research, the most updated numbers on Palestinian refugees and IDPs, along with other statistics as well. Demographic data, socioeconomic situation, the breakup between registered and non-registered, those living in camps, those not living in camps, what camps continue to exist today, which ones are recognized, which ones are not recognized. So if you really want to get into the nitty-gritty of the details, I encourage you to go to our website and download the most recent version of the survey of Palestinian refugees and IDPs. The next edition of the survey is due to come out next year. I hope. I have my fingers crossed. It's a huge production. And believe it or not, it is Badil that produces this piece of research, and not UNRWA, and not the UNCCP, and not any other UN organization, as it should be. It's us.
But how are they allowing you to do that? Because, you know, refugees are all over the world, and moving in the Arab world is very hard. You have to have a visa, you have to have a visa.
Yeah, it's very complicated. Yeah. That's why we need a huge team of researchers to be able to pull off this research. And so we have to do not only field research, but also we have to contact the different states and governments to see what kind of movement has occurred. And as you know, not all refugees go in and say, hey, I want to claim refuge or I'm seeking asylum here, because of the restrictions put on seeking refuge and asylum. Yeah. So it's a huge task, and we try to do the best we can. In some areas, we can't get completely accurate numbers, and this is explained in the survey and how we reach the numbers that we have. We do it very statistically, very scientifically, when it's not possible to get actual firsthand data. Okay? So I'm not going to talk about the mechanisms that were used by Israel in the Nakba or the Nexa. I think that if you would like to have more information on that, I would be more than happy to provide it, or it's provided within our research, and there are many other sources as well. What I would like to talk about in more detail is this coercive environment, okay, and how displacement is happening today, okay, because I think this is important. I think it's important to know that things haven't changed, that displacement is still occurring, and there is an intention by Israel to control the maximum amount of land with the minimum number of Palestinians living on that land. And in order to achieve this goal or to have this intention, there has to be a way to rid the land of its indigenous population, namely the Palestinians. And this is occurring on both sides of the Green Line. It's happening against Palestinians with Israeli citizenship, who are citizens of Israel, and it's happening against Palestinians who are under occupation in the territory taken over in 1967. So it doesn't matter if you're a Palestinian on the right side, let's say, of the Green Line, or if you're a Palestinian living elsewhere. Your daily life is affected by the laws and policies that are implemented by Israel. And Israel has complete control, if not, I guess I shouldn't say complete, but very solid control of both what is now Israel and the occupied territory of 1967, even after the so-called peace agreement or peace treaty, which is the Oslo Accords. To make this just very clear and simple, the best way to force people off land is to control the land, right? And so many of the policies that Israel and other states use are land control mechanisms or land control policies. Now, we've determined that there are 9 policies that Israel uses in general, and we have categorized these 9 policies and have started publishing papers on each of these policies, which Shana and Elsa also worked on. So the first 4 policies you see here of those 9 are the ones that are most closely associated with land. So we talk about things like the permit regime, discriminatory zoning and planning, denial of access to natural resources and services, and land confiscation and denial of use. Now, all four of those we have actually produced papers on, and you can find the details of the different Israeli laws and military orders and so on and so forth and cases in those working papers. But what I would like to do is just give a quick example and show how it works on the ground. Let's pretend that I'm a farmer from Qalqilya. And this is happens to be an aerial photo of Qalqilya, this lower picture right here. And as you can see in the aerial photo, Qalqilya is completely surrounded by the wall, as you can see there. And there is one entrance and exit point to Qalqilya, which is manned by the Israeli military, and that is right here. Now, let's suppose or pretend that I'm a farmer from Qalqilya and I live here. Okay. But my lands are on the other side of the wall. Okay. And let's go ahead and make another assumption that I have all the permits I need to be able to reach my land. Because before I would just go and I would be there and I would be at my lands and I would be farming. And I'd probably have my family with me because, you know, it's a joint effort, that type of thing. It's a family passed on from generation to generation, and the whole family is involved. So I just go across in whatever transportation vehicle I had or even by walking, and I'd get to my land, and I'd farm my land, and I'd bring the produce home, and I'd sell it at market, and I'd have money to buy my kids clothes and put them through school and finish, you know, paint the house or do whatever I need to do. But now I have to go all the way down through the different checkpoints, around the different barriers that exist and obstacles to get to my land. And in order to be able to do that, I have to have the right permits, correct? So we're going to go ahead and assume that we have those permits, even though in reality I probably don't, right? The second thing we're going to assume is that I have the financial and physical capacity to make that journey, which is much longer than what it was before the wall was created, right? Okay. So, I managed to get to my land, but when I get there, I find that I have no access to water. What do I do? Under a normal situation, you petition the state, you submit for a permit to build a water cistern, or you submit for the state to extend the water, public water services to your area of land so that I can irrigate the land and farm the land, correct? So I will go to Israel and I submit for a permit. What are the chances that my permit to develop or build a cistern or add an addition to my house or to fence in my land or to build a retaining wall, or to do any of these type of things that could potentially need to be done to my land? What is the likelihood that my permit will get approved?
Zero.
Oh, you guys have no faith. 1%. So you're very close. I would have given it to you. Yeah, I would have given it to you. 1%. What is the likelihood if an Israeli, a Jewish Israeli, went to Israel and submitted for a permit? Close. 98.7, I believe, is what it is. The approval rate for an Israeli, Jewish Israeli who submits for a permit. So you can see that there's clearly something going on there. Okay. Now, let's take another step and say, I have the permits. I am physically and financially capable. And I get to my land, and I already have access to water because the land has been in my family for generations. And we have the foresight to build a cistern, so we've been collecting rainwater forever because we've been farmers forever, and the land's been in our family forever. But I get there, and I've been informed by the Israeli Civil Administration that my land has been converted to a military zone. Or my land has been converted into an archaeological dig. Or my land has been converted into a natural reserve, and so I'm prohibited from touching it, even though it's my land. And they didn't consult me. I wasn't included in the planning and zoning process when they did this. And so they prevent me from accessing my land. And so I can't touch it. So you can see how the policies, if one doesn't get you, the other one will. But the sad fact of the matter is that Palestinians are faced with multiple policies at the same time. So I won't have the permits that I need, whether it's for mobility or whether it's to develop the land. And they will have rezoned or allotted my land for a different planning purpose than what I would want it to be or what I need it to be. And they would deny me access to natural resources. And they would prevent me from using the land. And they would eventually end up confiscating it and taking it away from me. Does that make sense? Because that's what happens every day in Palestine. That's what's happening every day in Palestine. The other policies include suppression of resistance, which is also available for you on our website. Here we talk about collective punishment and punitive practices like arbitrary detention, punitive home demolitions, and things like this. Non-state actions with the implicit consent of the state. Here we look at the role of non-governmental organizations like the Jewish National Fund or the World Zionist Organizations. We also look at corporate complicity. When private corporations are involved in human rights violations in the occupied territory. And we also look at colonial or settler violence. Now, two notes here. We have produced two papers on corporate complicity. If that's something that interests you, those are the papers I would recommend that you go to. And they're very clearly labeled corporate complicity and violations of international law in the occupied territory. I don't know if Shana worked on that one. I don't think Shana, because those ones are a little older.
She was worked on the seam zone.
Yeah, she did work on the seam zone, occasional bulletin, yeah. In terms of settler colonial or Israeli civilian violence against Palestinians, the trend in the last 4 years is that Israeli civilian violence against Palestinians has gone up considerably, by about 400%. Yes. Now, the sad fact of the matter is not only has it increased exponentially, but also there are no accountability mechanisms. So if an Israeli were to commit a violent act against a Palestinian, there wouldn't be any consequences. And we've seen this happen repeatedly. And this is probably why it's on the rise, because you know, even if you were to do something very bad, you wouldn't get in trouble. So why not do it? On the other hand, Palestinian violence against Israeli civilians or military has gone down by almost 100% in the last 4 or 5 years. So that's something to think about as well.
Is that violence gone down because of the wall?
I don't think so. While Israel claims that the wall was created for security purposes, it really was more of a land grab mechanism. Because if you follow the path of the wall, you will see that it, what it takes in on its, on the Israeli side, is the agricultural land, the land that is primed for agriculture, the best agricultural land, or land that they need in order to connect two colonies or two settlements together to create this continuous mass or continuous piece of land in order to connect those areas with Israel proper and with Jerusalem. Or it's where there are significant water reserves, reservoirs. So all Palestinian water, or let me rephrase that, all water reservoirs within the West Bank are on the other side, on the Israeli side of the wall. And that was intentional because they want to make sure that they have access to that very vital natural resource. Because without water, what are you going to do? So all the water within the West Bank is under the control of Israel. And part of the path of the wall was to make sure that this is going to happen. So I don't think it's the wall that was the deterrence for the violence.
The demolition of houses of the Palestinians is a factor, a big factor. In reducing the resistance.
There's definitely more fear and less resistance among Palestinians. But I wouldn't say that. I think most studies have shown that when things like that happen to people, the response is not quite what they want it to be. In most cases, a punitive home demolition or an administrative home demolition causes people to become more aggressive, not less aggressive. Those are what international studies have shown. Has any specific study been done on Palestinians who experience home demolitions? Not yet, but it would be interesting to see. Other things that cause a coercive environment, of course, is the denial of reparations. Reparations, of course, is the legal term for return, and it includes physical repatriation, property restitution, compensation, and guarantees of non-repetition. Now, how does Israel prevent Palestinians from attempting or implementing return on their own or without the assistance of the international community? They, of course, created a law, and it's called the Prevention of Infiltration Law. The Prevention of Infiltration Law came onto the Israeli law books in 1954, but it was actually implemented retroactively, and there was a reason for the creation of the Prevention of Infiltration Law. Because shortly after the cessation of armed conflict in 1948, and Israel declared its independence, thousands of Palestinian refugees attempted to return. They did not think that they wouldn't be able to return, because when they left, they took their keys and what they could carry on their backs and left, assuming that they would be gone for a few weeks, a month most at tops, 2 months maybe, and then they would be allowed to return and carry on with their lives. So they did attempt to return. And this created a very embarrassing situation for the newly created state. They had just expended all this effort in order to get rid of the Palestinians. It wouldn't make much sense to allow them to return. And so they created the Prevention of Infiltration Law. The Prevention of Infiltration Law says that any individual attempting to enter Israel illegally will be dealt with in 3 ways. 1, this individual would be shot on sight, and thousands of Palestinians who attempted to return were shot on sight. 2, they would be arrested and detained for 2-year periods that could be renewed at the whim of the state. Thousands more were arrested and detained. 3, they would be arrested and forced back into exile. And thousands more were arrested and forced back into exile. And so this is what the law that is preventing Palestinians from returning without assistance from the international community. Now, the law has been expanded in recent times to also include individuals who engage in activities that Israel doesn't really condone, like saying bad things about Israel, or encouraging boycott, divestment, and sanctions, or other such type activities that Israel is not too fond of. Okay? Institutionalized discrimination and segregation. Here is another law. It's called the Israeli Nationality Law. Now, I'd like to say that Israel has many such laws. And institutionalized discrimination is kind of like the more acceptable term, let's say, or the less volatile term that means the same thing as apartheid. Now, people get nervous when we put Israel and apartheid together. But unfortunately, this is the situation that we have, because this is one of Israel's apartheid laws. Now, what is apartheid? Apartheid is when you put into law something that is discriminatory. You create a law that discriminates against a certain group of people based on, it could be sex or gender, It could be the color of their skin. It could be their religious denomination. It could be their ethnicity or identity, so on and so forth. The Israeli nationality law is one such law. As I said, there are many, and if we were to cover them all, I'd probably be here until tomorrow morning. But, and so would you guys, so we can't have that. But this is a very important law to know, because the Israeli nationality, well, let me say this. In most modern nation states, if you're a citizen of the state, you're also a national of the state. And those two terms, citizen and national, are usually synonymous and mean one and the same thing. For example, we are all here, I believe, American citizens, correct? If you look at our passports, the passports say that Mr. or Mrs. or Ms. so-and-so are citizens / nationals of the United States of America. And so in the U.S., if you're a citizen of the U.S., you're also a national of the U.S. This is not the case for Israel. There is a big distinction between being a national of Israel and between being a citizen of Israel. To be a national of Israel, according to this law, you have to be Jewish. So, if you're not Jewish, you are something else. You're not a national. You are labeled or given the title or given the status of citizen. And there's a huge distinction between being a national of Israel and between being a citizen of Israel. This law sets up this segregation based on religious denomination. In addition to that, there is a whole host of other laws that prevent, that grant rights to nationals, but not to citizens. Now, nationals, as we said, are those who are considered Jewish by Israel. Who are the citizens? The non-Jewish population of Israel. Who is the non-Jewish population of Israel? The Palestinians. Okay? So you can see that this is clearly an apartheid law. Denial of residency. This one has also been published by Bedil. Most people associate denial of residency with Palestinians living in Jerusalem. Why? Because Palestinians living in Jerusalem do not have Israeli citizenship. They have what is called residency status, which is like being an alien resident in your own city. Okay? So they have an even lower legal status according to Israeli law, which means they are discriminated against even more severely according to Israeli law. And so this residency status allows Israel to withdraw or deny residency to Palestinians who live in Jerusalem on an administrative, usually very superficial type reason. But Israel actually has the authority, or has granted itself the authority, to deny residency to any Palestinian, because they're in control of the population registry, and they get to decide who will get which status, and if they will get which status. Does that make sense? Because that's what happens. I'm going to stop there, maybe take some questions.
You have been listening to Lubna Shomali, representing the Palestinian refugee organization Badil, speaking at the Lincoln Public Library. And that is our program this morning. Thank you for listening to This Week in Palestine, a weekly feature of Truth and Justice Radio. You'll find us here at 90.3 FM every Sunday morning at 8 a.m. You can also stream us live on your computer at wzbc.org. To access our permanent archive to hear any of our past broadcasts, go to truthandjusticeradio.org, all one word, truthandjusticeradio.org, and click on This Week in Palestine Archive. This archive was developed and is maintained by our colleague Stan Robinson. We thank you for your time, and we hope you will join us again next Sunday and every Sunday. And this is John Roberts wishing you a good morning.